Good morning, church. If you are new here, if this is your first time with us, I want to welcome you. My name is Alex. I'm a pastor here, and we are so glad that you are here with us this morning to worship. If you would, before we come to our text this morning, would you pray with me?
God, we thank you for this day.
And we thank you for the breath in our lungs and this gift of life. God, we too often, I think, take for granted the fact that when we gather together, and we hear your word. And we are hearing the words of the God of the universe. It is a marvelous and wondrous thing to come before you and to hear from you and to be shaped and formed by your word through the power of your spirit. Lord, let us not take this for granted, but instead to come before you in humility and in awe, wanting your will to be done in our lives and through our lives. It's in your son's name we pray, amen. If you are able, would you please stand for the reading of the word? We're going to continue our study in Acts. We're going to look at Paul's trial before Festus. We're going to start in Acts 25, verse 1, actually. It's going to be up here on the screen. Acts 25, verse 1. Maybe. Midway. Oh, I'm so sorry. That's my fault. I'm blind. Acts 25, verse 1. Now, 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea, and the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul, and they urged him, asking as a favor against Paul that he summon him to Jerusalem because they were planning an ambush to kill him on the way. Now Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea and that he himself intended to go there shortly. So said he, let the men of authority among you go down with me. And if there is anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him. After he stayed among them, not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. And the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove. Paul argued in his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me? But Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar. Then Festus, when he had conferred with his council, answered, to Caesar you have appealed, and to Caesar you shall go. We'll stop there at the word of the Lord. You may be seated. Last week, we began this courtroom drama, where now Paul is under custody of the Roman Empire. He is on trial before the Romans, not just the Jews, and the Jews are functioning as the prosecution. They are making their charges against Paul before the Romans. And last week, we looked at Paul's first trial with the Romans. He stood before the Roman governor, Felix. And in that whole debate, in that whole courtroom drama, we saw that Felix effectively found no issue with Paul whatsoever. Felix was a man who was familiar with Judaism. He was familiar also with the way of Jesus to a degree. And so he was intrigued by Paul. He was interested in Paul. He essentially saw that there was no evidence to back up the Jews' claims against him in any way, shape, or form. But Felix did not have the courage or strength or even necessarily the desire to set Paul free. He kept Paul detained, even though there was no evidence of any wrongdoing whatsoever. And he met with Paul occasionally, actually hoping to get a bribe from Paul. He was hoping to use Paul for his own gain. So he kept Paul in prison to satisfy the Jews in order to try to keep peace, even hoping that he could gain money or power or status throughout the process. Well, if you look at the very end of Acts chapter 24, it says this, now after 2 years passed, in verse 27, Acts 24, 27, when 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by a new governor, Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. So Felix is effectively coming to the end of his term as governor over this region. A new man is coming up, Governor Festus, and Felix, as his, you know, final decision, is going to keep Paul in prison. He's going to keep these charges held against Paul, even though there's no evidence. And now it's Festus's job to come in to hear Paul's case and to try to decide if Paul is actually innocent or not. So the passage that we just read is Festus's, the new governor, Governor Festus's engagement with Paul and the Jews. Now, remember what I said last week. The Jews have one of two goals here. The Jews will win if they can do one of two things. The first goal is if they can get, you know, Paul found guilty and executed by the Romans. All right, that's a win for them. The other way the Jews can win is if they can get the trial moved away from the Roman Empire and back to Jerusalem under the Jewish authority and rule. Because if they can get Paul away from the security he has by the Romans while he's kept under guard there, then they can assassinate them. And this even gets reiterated in the passage that we just looked at in the beginning of chapter 25. When the Jews meet with Festus, they ask, hey, bring Paul back to Jerusalem. Governor Festus, they're trying to talk him up. They're trying to make his new job easy. They're like, you're coming into this new job, right? You've got a lot on your plate. You don't need to deal with this man, Paul. You don't need to try to hear him out or anything. That's just something you don't need to do. Why don't you send him back to Jerusalem with us, and we'll take care of him? And by take care of him, they mean they want to kill him, right? Which, the interesting thing to me is that if you remember a couple of weeks ago, we looked at a passage in Acts where there was a whole group of Jewish men who made essentially a promise. They made a vow that they would not eat or drink until they had killed Paul. And I find it funny that Acts says, now 2 years later, Paul's still alive. I want to know what happened to those men. Did they keep their vow or not? I mean, if I was a betting man, maybe they would keep their vow. I don't know. People are pretty intense about vows. I don't know. That's just a little side note. It's a funny thing to me. But here's the situation. It's been multiple years now. The Jews still have this intense hatred for Paul and want to do everything they can to destroy the way of Jesus because they believe that the way of Jesus is heresy and is an act of war against the Jewish faith. Now, the interesting thing to remember here is that even though the narrative focuses on Paul and we've, you know, time skipped by 2 years, the way of Jesus is still active and alive and growing and spreading. Even though Paul is in chains here, it's not like he's the only Christian. It's not like he's the only evangelist. Like, the way of Jesus is continuing to expand and increase and grow throughout the entire world. And the enemies of God, now the Jewish people, who are supposed to be the people of God, but now they function as the enemies of God, they can't even destroy this one person, which I find absolutely fascinating. But anyway, Paul is now standing here before a new governor, and the new governor is very dead set. He's very interested in hearing Paul's case. So he tells the Jews, he says, no, we're not going to move it back to Jerusalem. I know Paul is in Caesarea. There I will hear his case. So Governor Festus gets all set up in the tribunal. He brings Paul in, he brings the prosecution in, and he wants to hear the case. And he hears the Jews make all kinds of very serious charges against him, charges that should lead him to execution if he's found guilty. But as Governor Festus hears the Jews make the claim against Paul, just like Felix before him, he finds absolutely no evidence whatsoever for these claims. Just like Felix, Governor Festus sees there's absolutely zero evidence to convict Paul that he is guilty and worthy of death. And Paul knows this. Paul's very bold. He's very brash about this. Paul says, I have done no wrong whatsoever, and there is zero evidence to convict me otherwise. But there's this back and forth here. As Governor Festus can't find any evidence of any wrongdoing, at least against the Roman Empire, Festus asks Paul, would you like to go back to Jerusalem? Now, here's the interesting thing about Festus in comparison to Governor Felix. Last week, when we were talking about Governor Felix, Felix was a man who was informed about Judaism. He was informed about the way of Jesus, so he had a degree of knowledge about the religion. Governor Festus, on the other hand, is pretty far removed from Judaism and from the way of Jesus. So he's not, he doesn't have like any kind of real education or familiarity with the religion of the Jews and all that they're arguing about. So he seems pretty sensible to him that if this is an issue of Jewish religion, then it should go back to Jerusalem. It should be a matter of Jewish faith and Jewish religion that they should figure out, because he can't see any wrongdoing whatsoever, at least against the Roman Empire. But Paul knows that if that's what happens, it's going to be a death sentence for him. So Paul stands his ground. He says, no, I am in the Roman tribunal. I am in Caesar's court. This is where I'm going to stay. This is where I'm going to stake my innocence. Paul has no problem remaining under Roman custody because he knows that he is completely innocent, and he knows that if it goes back to Jerusalem, he will be killed. And so we get this mention in verse 12, Acts 25, verse 12. After Festus had conferred with his council, he declared to Paul, "You have appealed to Caesar you will go." Now let's look at what happens right after the discussion between Festus and Paul, starting in chapter 25, verse 13. Now a few days later, King Agrippa and his sister Bernice arrived at Caesarea to pay their respects to Festus. They greeted him. And as they stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There is a man left prisoner by Felix, and when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answered them that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charges laid against him. So when they came together here, I made no delay. But on the next day, I took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. Being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them. But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, he said, you will hear him. So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Then at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had done nothing deserving death. And as he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to go ahead and send him. But I have nothing definitive to write to my lord about him. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charges against him. So this is what happens. Festus meets with Paul. They do their initial hearing, and Festus can't find anything at all wrong with Paul regarding the Roman emperor. He sees no evidence whatsoever that Paul has done anything to disrupt the peace, to wage war against the empire, anything worthy of death whatsoever. So Festus wants to send Paul back to Jerusalem so that the Jewish people can handle this matter that's regarding Jewish religion and Jewish faith. But Paul refuses because he knows that's a death sentence. So Governor Festus is kind of sitting there being like, I don't really know what to do. Paul has said on making this an issue of Roman legal authority, but I can't find any evidence whatsoever that he's done anything against the Roman Empire. So now this other guy comes into the picture. His name's King Agrippa. Now, King Agrippa is a politician in the Roman Empire. He has Jewish heritage, and we're going to engage with him next week because Paul is going to make his defense against King Agrippa next week. But the interesting thing to note here for this text today is that King Agrippa is very familiar with the Jewish faith. He himself is of Jewish descent. So he comes to town and he meets with Governor Festus. And Festus says to him, look, I don't really know what to do with this guy. I'm not familiar enough with the Jewish faith and the Jewish religion to really understand what all they're arguing about. I know they're arguing about some guy named Jesus. And the Jews claim he's dead and Paul claims he's alive. And that's about it. I have no idea what to write to Rome to tell Rome what Paul is being charged with, because it's obvious that he's not guilty of all of the claims that the Jews are making. So he says to King Agrippa, look, I need your help. You're familiar with the Jewish faith. I need you to hear Paul to help me understand what I should communicate to Rome. And that sets up the third chapter in the courtroom drama. This is the fascinating thing to me, and I think for our application from this text today, that we should take home. Festus is a man who is not familiar with the Jewish faith. He's not familiar with the Jewish religion. He does not understand most, if any, of that. But there is one thing that he understands crystal clear, and that he sees Paul's character. Festus cannot understand, and he can't even engage with the discussions regarding Jewish doctrine and Jewish belief and Jewish practice and all of that. But he sees crystal clear that Paul is an upright man, that Paul is a man of peace. He has not caused any disruption. He has not caused any violence. He has not caused any desecration. From a Roman perspective, Festus sees Paul as an upright, peaceful citizen. That is crystal clear to him. Now, here's the thing for us today. This is where it goes into application. When you go out into the world and when you interact with people, they may not understand your faith and your religion. It was taken for granted at a different time that, like, everyone in our culture at least had this baseline understanding of Christian faith and doctrine and practice. And that more and more and more is eroding, especially as our culture enters into a post-Christian era, which we don't need to get into the details of now. But the point is that you are going to interact with people. They're not going to understand your faith. They're not going to understand your religion. They're not going to understand your doctrine. And the longer time goes on, the more and more and more they're not going to understand it unless they've experienced it themselves. But they will know one thing about you, and it will be crystal clear to them. They will see your character. They may not understand why you gather together with the rest of your church to sing songs to a God. They will not understand why you gather together and you take the bread and you take the cup and you take Jesus' body and blood, right? That might seem very off-putting to them. And, right? Throughout all of human history, many, many people have claimed us to be cannibals in that regard, right? They may not understand your theology about worship or salvation or eternity or anything like that, but they will understand. You will not have to explain to them whatsoever your character. They will see how you live. They will see how you interact with others. They will hear how you speak. They will watch how you engage day after day after day. The people you work with, the friends you hang out with, everyone around you, what will be crystal clear to them will be your character. This is what is on display between Governor Festus and Paul. He's not familiar with Paul's faith. He's not familiar with Paul's religion, but he sees Paul crystal clear as a man of peace. It is undeniable. There's absolutely nothing. Festus has no idea what to write to Rome that could be anything wrong with this man. He's at a complete loss. That's why he meets with King Agrippa and asks King Agrippa for help. Because he says, I don't know what to write. It seems nonsensical for me to send this man to Rome without actually giving Rome any kind of charge of wrongdoing. Festus sees Paul's character and knows that Paul's character is upright and righteous and peaceful. When you interact with people in the world, they may not know your faith. They may not know your religion. It may be odd to them. And maybe you even try to tell them about it and they're confused by it. But the thing they will not be confused by, the thing that they will see with crystal clear clarity, is how you live. And the truth is that if you want to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ to the rest of the world, then you must have a character that actually imitates the character and life of Christ. They may find your faith and your doctrine, your theology to be strange, but they will understand your character. And the truth is that the outside world either has a positive reputation of the church or a negative reputation of the church, based not on necessarily the teachings of the church or how great the music is at the church or the art we produce. The world has a positive or negative perception of the church based on the church's character. When people who claim to follow Jesus completely fail to imitate Christ and instead act in hate, it puts a stain on the church. When people who claim to follow Christ hurt other human beings, it puts a stain on the church. And in the current culture and current age, where more and more and more people's hidden character is being exposed, the church has borne many stains. And people want nothing to do with a theology that is connected to that kind of character. If you want to play a part in fulfilling the Great Commission, it cannot just be in your words. It has to be in your day-to-day life. The best way you will lead people to Christ is by living a life where your character is blameless and faultless, to where people will look at you and they will say, I don't understand your religion, I don't understand your theology, but I cannot find any wrongdoing in you. And this is what I said last week. The thing that I find interesting is that if you compare Governor Felix and Governor Festus, is that Felix actually has some understanding of the Jewish faith and of the way of Jesus, but he doesn't really engage with Paul in any kind of real honest way. Instead, he keeps Paul in chains and interacts with him a bit, but ultimately hopes that he can gain money or power or status from the situation by using Paul. Festus seems to be a lot more earnest with wanting to try to make the right decision, but he's confused about how to do it because he's less familiar with the Jewish faith and religion. Yet this is the thing that Festus will absolutely stand on, is that Paul and his character seems to be blameless. Do you live a life that when people look at you and they watch you and they hear you, when they see what you post on social media, when they watch you interact with your children, when they see how you interact with your coworkers, do you live a life in such a way that the outside world, who may not know Jesus whatsoever and may be confused by Jesus and may be confused by the church, do you live a life in such a way that the people who are confused by that religion can yet see with crystal clear clarity that you are a person living in imitation of Christ? Because if they can't see that, it does not matter what you tell them. It does not matter how you can explain to them your theology. It does not matter how you explain your religion to them. If they do not see the Christ-like character in your life, they will want nothing to do with your faith. But if you live in such a way where day by day by day you imitate the holiness of Christ, even in the midst of their confusion, they will want to know what you believe. And they will know that what you believe is actually backed up by your deeds, that it's not just talk, it's not just words, but that you've dedicated your life to the way of Christ. The only reason Paul is even alive in this moment is that he has lived a holy life, to where there's no dirt that can be found on him whatsoever, which I think is fascinating during a time of an election season, where you see people just doing everything they can. Like, the number one thing you see in any kind of political environment whatsoever is we are going to find all of the dirt on our opponent that we can possibly get. And there are politicians who at many times appeared like they were just going to skyrocket into success. And then someone found a little bit of dirt and it just absolutely and they faded away into obscurity. Right? The Jews have had 2 years to do everything they could to find as much dirt as possible on this man. And yet when they stand before Governor Festus and they make all kinds of charges, there is zero evidence whatsoever. Paul has lived a blameless life. That is the only reason why he is even alive in this moment. And because he has lived a life of holy character, he now has the opportunity over and over and over again in this courtroom drama to point countless people to Christ. Your holy character is not just so you can be a good person, so you can go to heaven. Your holy character is a tool that God uses to fulfill the Great Commission. Few people will be convinced by your words. Many people will be convinced by your actions. Do you live in such a way that when people see you, even if they don't know Jesus, they can see Jesus in you? Is it evident in your life? That is what we as followers of the way of Jesus strive for, that day after day after day after day, we grow in our faith and maturity. That doesn't just mean we grow in a head knowledge of knowing Jesus more, but that we actually day by day by day become more like Jesus. Do you live in such a way that you pursue Christ and you come before God and say, God, have your way. Let your will be done in my life. Or do we function like Governor Felix, where we come to God and try to use him in order for us to get what we want? Because that kind of relationship with God will never produce holy character in us. Instead, we must be a humble people who recognize there's nothing we can do to earn our salvation. That we come before Christ and say, Christ, just as the potter molds and shapes the clay, God, shape and form my life according to your will. Let your will be done in my life. Are we a people who grow in our holiness, who grow in our character, who are being shaped and formed by Christ in order to lead the world to Christ? Let us be a people who leave here this morning knowing that we are in the hands of that potter, who humble ourselves before God and say, God, you have saved me. You own me. Have your way. Let your will be done in my life so that I might be a better image of Christ to the world. If you would you pray with me? God, we are your people. We belong to you. God, shape us and form us in such a way that we will be people of Christ-like character. Not in order to obtain salvation, but because of our salvation, you have saved us in order to make us holy. Lord, let us be a people that regardless of anything in the world, any situation, whether it's chaotic or whether it's peaceful, whether it's easy, whether it's hard, whether we are experiencing great success or whether we experience great failure, let us be a people that whatever comes our way, we will stand firm, knowing that you love us, knowing that you have given us your Spirit, and knowing that you are shaping us and forming us to be the people you call us to be. May we be a people of strong, mature, holy character that will be evident through every season and every storm. It is in your Son's name we pray these words. Amen.